Hello, welcome to By Design. Fenella Kernebone with you. Great to join you. Coming up today, an experiment in communal living, design in China, and Dior's new look. On the show today, if you look at any number of products in your home, you'll undoubtedly find the words made in China on some. Today, our panel explores how that familiar label is being challenged from made in to designed in China. And as you get older, where and how you'll live as your bodies and needs change is a question that comes up often on the show. But would you choose a communal living arrangement?
We did a lot of brainstorming on it and took notes of what we wanted. And one of them was, considering that we're all getting older, proximity to a hospital. So, you know, we had to be reasonably close so that an ambulance could take us off to a hospital quickly.
Far enough away from Sydney to get out of there, but close enough if we needed to come back for a variety of different reasons. And it's far enough for nobody to attempt to commute.
On By Design, an experimental communal home coming up when we head in the field. But we begin in the world of fashion with a designer whose name has been synonymous with luxury and elegance since he launched his first collection in 1947, Christian Dior. And in the years after World War II, Dior wasn't just thinking about the European markets because he also had Australia on his mind. Sydney hosted the first ever Dior collection to be shown outside of Paris. And here, his designs, known as the new look, found an adoring audience. So joining me on By Design is Margot Riley, dress historian at the State Library of New South Wales. Welcome.
Okay, thank you.
Tell me, take me back to the 1940s, when Christian Dior first emerged on the scene. It was just after the war. Describe what the climate was for fashion for him that he was entering into.
Well, the Paris had been shut down. The couture houses really weren't producing very much. So the rest of the world had no new fashion information from Paris before the war, 1939. So different pockets of design had popped up. American designers were creating their own looks. Australian designers were working away, but under quite difficult circumstances because all the efforts were being put towards the war, making uniforms. So this was the climate. The war was over. People wanted to get away from the restrictions and the seriousness of wartime and think about freedom and fun and glamour. And
these
romance.
And these are the reasons. This is a very interesting period for you, isn't it, as a dress historian?
Definitely, because especially for Australia, I think it was decided that we were going to be part of the modern world and that we should have our own designers. And this was a time, and businessmen came together. There was Charles Lloyd-Jones, Norman Meyer and Frank Packer, who decided that they would put together an exhibition of French design and they would bring it to Australia to kickstart the Australian garment, the garment industry, and to get everybody talking and wanting to shop and to buy new clothes.
And the actual time, though, because this is post-war, so it was a time of austerity in Europe, in Paris
in
particular.
Yes,
it was a time of restraint as well. But Dior was anything but restrained when it came to his new ideas and his new fashion, wasn't
he? Yes. Well, he was very fortunate in that he had the financial backing of a textile magnate, Boussac. So he had actually access to fabric. He had masses and masses, yards and yards of fabric. But unfortunately, anybody who wasn't buying from a couture house didn't. And there wasn't a lot in the shops either. You know, it was old stock. They hadn't actually been able to make new clothes for four or five years. So I think that was such a shock for people to see these new designs, which were nothing like what was around before. So it sort of blew all the old designs out of the water. You looked old-fashioned overnight.
So what was these new designs? What was the new look? How different was it? Because
yes,
I think we're talking about maybe even 20 metres of material for
yards
one
and
dress.
Yards of fabric. But it was...
That's extravagant today.
Very extravagant. During wartime, it was a very boxy kind of business-like silhouette for women, and a bit like a uniform, you know, had a fitted jacket and a very narrow knee-length skirt. Dior came along and he wanted to bring back the romance of fashion and the glamour. So he dropped skirts down to just above the ankle, full skirts with lots and lots of material. And the jackets were very structured, nipped in waist. Women actually had to go back to wearing like a little corselet, a little girdle around the waist. Yes, yeah, a waspy waist to bring their waists in. And that, of course, made, you know, you had rounded shoulders and sort of prominent busts but nipped in waists and curvy hips.
Were there any unusual colours or new sort of styles, I suppose? Hem lengths were very different?
Hem length was definitely the big change. It was probably more, less patterns perhaps, more solid, elegant colours and silhouettes that he was drama. It was about drama, you know, theatricality and almost like the ballet. If you think of the silhouette of the classical ballerina, that was the image that he was recreating.
As you were telling me earlier, Margot, Australia had already brought out a series of garments through this collective, yes, through the department stores. Yes. Was this in 1947, wasn't it?
That was 46.
That was in 46. Yeah,
so they came to Australia in August 46, that first exhibition, which was just an exhibition. You couldn't buy anything. So it was sort of very tantalising. Everybody could see all these things and were desperate, but
they
couldn't buy them.
And then Dior decided he was going to bring his new look to Australia.
He launched his collection, his new house in 47, in February 47, and David Jones signed a licensing agreement straight after so that they would be able to bring the Dior clothes to Australia and make the copies in their workrooms in Sydney.
But why Sydney? Why Australia?
Yeah. I think because Dior was aware that the economy in France had suffered hugely in Europe because of war, and he was looking for areas that were untouched by war because they would have people who could afford to buy these garments and, you know, would bump up the French export. And that's what he was keen to do. It was a new couture house. He was coming into an already packed couture market, and he had to carve out a niche for himself. He had financial backers that were looking for him to make a profit very, very quickly, and he couldn't rely on the existing market. He had to find new markets.
But why was Australia in particular such a good market? What was our presence like in Paris at these fashion shows?
Yeah.
I hear that we were actually considered to be quite stylish. Is that
right?
Well,
this is true. And it's something that seems a bit bizarre to us because we have this idea that Australia was behind the times and dowdy and all the rest of it. But I think
not true.
Australian women made a real effort when they were travelling back to England to see their family and their friends. They went back by boat. They travelled via France. They would buy whole new wardrobes, and they were looking, you know, top-notch.
Pretty spick, yeah.
Pretty spick. Yeah. and I think that was the illusion, that we all looked like that all the time.
But was it also because of the fact that our wool experts, basically,
yes,
so wool exports, I should say, yes, is that something to do with it as well?
I think so. Australia was a primary producer of wool, and the French were very aware of they had a very strong relationship with Australia. They were buying the raw wool from Australian manufacturers, producers, and they were quite keen because they were buying all this wool, sell something back to Australia so that they could right the balance of trade.
Okay. On By Design, I'm speaking with dress historian from the State Library of New South Wales, Margot Riley, and we're talking about Christian Dior, who was, well, basically he brought his first collection to Australia outside of the European market. Sydney was the first location, which I think is quite fascinating. And in fact, this week in Sydney, a new flagship
store.
Dior store has also opened.
The first in Australia.
As well. So tell me a bit about how the designs of Dior came to be shown around the country. Who was seeing them? Who was buying them?
Well, this, as I say, this group show came out in 47, and then the exclusive couture show from Christian Dior came in 48. And you would buy tickets. It was advertised in the newspaper. People would pay their X number of shillings and go along. It was like afternoon tea, and you would go along and you'd get to watch this fabulous fashion show. But imagine you were seeing this on French mannequins. They felt that Australian women couldn't show the clothes. We didn't have the experience. Our models didn't have the international experience, so they actually brought these glamorous French mannequins out to Australia.
And they would have been superstars as well,
I
imagine.
Oh, they were. They just, you know, everyone took the whole place by riot. A couple of them actually married Australian men and stayed here. the lady who ran the parades, Madame Chambrelong, also married and stayed in Australia. So they took back all these wonderful stories to Paris and said, oh, look, if you get a chance to go to Australia, you have to go.
Go to Australia. So our reputation grew then as well. And as you say, Margot, these shows were huge. They actually even warranted newsreels.
Yes,
is that right?
That's right. They because not everybody, of course, could go to a major city and see the parades. There were, you know, a discrete number of showings. But it was of such newsworthiness that the newsreels would come along and film the parades. And even if you couldn't get to the department store, even if you lived in a small country town, you would be able to see these parades at the cinema when you went to watch the feature.
You mentioned before that they brought over French mannequins or models. What about Australian models?
Yeah.
How did that, in some ways, this experience of bringing Dior to Australia actually create a different type of industry?
It certainly increased the reputation of Australian models. They learned all the tricks of the trade from these French girls. A lot of them went back to Paris. Dior would then give them work because they'd worked in Australia. And Australian models, as they are today, we have an Australian face of Dior at the moment. And that, again, happened in the 1950s and 60s.
And what were their bodies? I hate to say it because I got myself a ruler and a tape measure before, and I think it was quite a small waist.
Yes,
I wouldn't be able to wear any of these clothes.
55 centimetres was which was about 20 inches. I don't even like to think what my waist measurement is because it just. And I think we have to think that these women. They were less. They were shorter, for one thing.
Yes.
They weren't nearly as tall. They did. They had come through the Depression and wartime deprivation, so they were small frame. They had a very small frame. They were wearing girdles. They were wearing waspy waists. So Australian girls today, I don't believe, have waists as you know, and 19-inch waist is just.
It's little.
Unimaginable.
The Australian women then watched the newsreels. They took on these clothes, of course, in the late 1940s and adopted the new look in a very big way. So tell me about the clothes themselves. Were they expensive? Did everybody buy them? Who went into these stores and purchased these clothes?
Yeah. There was a sort of a chain. Obviously, if you could go to Paris and go to the couture show, you could order directly from the house. That was the top price, and that was in the original fabric and all hand sewn. Then the next level was a license or a copy or a pattern, which was sold to a buyer. So you'd be able to go to the department store in Sydney, and they would have a particular range of things, and they'd be made up, some in the original fabric, some in copies. There would be dress patterns that were available in magazines, and you'd be able to do it at home. Then there were the mass-produced. So there was a whole hierarchy of different, but everybody adopted the style. It was certainly overnight a sensation.
So how did they adopt the style then? How did it infiltrate the entire Australian community?
That silhouette, that whole silhouette of lengthening skirts. There were, you know, instructions in the Women's Weekly about how to turn your pre-new look skirt into a new look by, you know, slashing the skirt and adding bands of fabric. And so they would try and adopt different aspects of the silhouette. And if you couldn't buy the new look, you would adapt what you had to fit as close as possible.
Looking back, I suppose, as a dress historian as well, what surprises you or interests you about how one designer, Christian Dior in particular, managed to create such an impact in that time in Australia, where for, what is it, a decade, the new look was paramount?
I think the swiftness of it, because they didn't photograph the runway parades the way we do today. The only people that got to go to that first showing were fashion editorial, so the editors of the magazines and private clients. There were no photographs taken. It took months for those official pictures to start coming out in the magazines. The first issue of Vogue that would report on the collections would come out like 3 or 4 months later. But the excitement was communicated to the newspapers. And that, it sort of whipped up into a frenzy. People were just ready for it. They were ready for a change like that.
And did it have an impact on Australian designers?
Definitely.
And what about their impact overseas even?
I don't know that you probably didn't get Australian designers going over to Europe and having an impact that way, but it increased the interest in fashion. Everybody was talking about it. It was on the front page of the newspapers. For the first time, you got headlines in the newspapers about fashion, which previously it had always been in magazines or on the women's pages. It was seen to be an economic, it was important economically, and you got new professions, models, fashion photographers, fashion media, and even things like the beginning of like Fashion Week. The first Fashion Week was in 1950 in Australia, and as was a direct result because there were people doing this work and they needed some way to let that information get out to
everybody
customers.
Else, certainly. If you could have one Dior new look, though, in your collection, very quickly, what would that be?
Oh, probably from one of the early collections. I just loved
with a bigger waist.
Yes,
for me too.
Yeah, nipped in waist, but a very very full skirt. Because his famous suit from the first collection, the bar suit, not one exists. It was obviously so popular, and people loved it. They wore it out, so there isn't one out there. If anyone's got one,
Margot would like to know
about
it. I'd
love to know.
Well, thank you so much for joining me on By Design. It's great to meet you and to talk with you, of course, about the origins of the new look and Australia's involvement in that as well. Thank you, Margot. Margot Riley there, who is the dress historian at the State Library of New South Wales, and you can find some links on our website. Coming up soon, the skyrocketing growth of the design market in China, not just manufacturing, but design. What opportunities does this provide for Australian designers? That is coming up in our panel later in the show.
The Australian Red Cross and the Queensland Government have launched a joint appeal, seeking donations to help those affected by flooding. Funds raised by the Queensland Floods Appeal 2013 will assist individuals, families and communities directly affected by the floods and recent tornadoes. To make a secure online donation, visit redcross.org.au or call 1800 811 700.
You're with Fenella Kernebone here on RN. And this is By Design.
Late last year on By Design, we visited a retirement village and we had a huge response from you. Many of you were very worried about moving into a retirement village. Well, we've found three couples who've dealt with some of the issues of designing a space for themselves and their bodies as they get older. Near Taree on the New South Wales mid-north coast, they've custom-built a home for all six of them to live through their retirement. They engaged local Taree architect John Basden, and the brief was for each couple to have a separate suite with a bedroom, bathroom, study and deck, the shared space, a large kitchen, dining and lounge room. So let's join producer Claudia Taranto with Heather, Michael, Rick and Judy.
Well, you've managed to do what a lot of baby boomers seem to dream about, which is saying, no thanks, I'm not going to go into the retirement village, I'm going to find a bunch of friends and get old gracefully together in the one living space. How have you managed to do it?
With a lot of planning. It's taken us 10 years or more to work the whole thing out together and get here and get settled together.
It also took a great deal of tenacity, because you can imagine the obstacles in the road that we came across. Finding a place was the first. Somebody would say, well, I don't like that, and I don't like living in the shade of that mountain, and I need to be nearer to a cappuccino, and I'm not sure I want to be right on the ocean where things would get rusted. And so little things would come up that we learned a lot about each other and certainly about ourselves.
We did a lot of brainstorming on it and took notes of what we wanted, and one of them was, considering that we're all getting older, proximity to a hospital. So, you know, we had to be reasonably close so that an ambulance could take us off to a hospital quickly.
Far enough away from Sydney to get out of there, but close enough if we needed to come back for a variety of different reasons. So it's about 4 hours away from Sydney, and that sort of works, and it's far enough for nobody to attempt to commute.
Now, you actually tried out living together in Sydney, first of all.
Yes.
What did you learn from that experience in terms of what you need in the design of a living space for each of the three couples to be separate enough but also together enough?
That it's very important to have private space and to have the choice of taking private time or being together with others. We did think for a while about having a shared workspace. And one of the things that we learned is that we've got quite different work styles, and some people do quiet work and some people do a lot of talking work and so on. So we worked out that it was better for us to have our individual study space, as you see here, rather than a shared one.
One of the big things we've got out of the shared space is an enormous economy. The amount of money we're saving just in the shared space is wonderful. For six people, one stove, one top and one oven is really all you need. And to have any more would be just a tragic waste of money. We can spend it on other things much better. It makes our money go a lot farther. Another thing about the shared space that's fun is just having the people. That was one of the things I discovered in Longueville. It was fun to be with my friends. It was more than just convenience, and it was more than just saving money. It was actually fun. So to be able to be private, anytime I've had too much of people, I can just close the door and come in here and sit on my computer. But most of the time I like to hang out with Michael or Judy and just chit-chat about whatever's going on in the world or our lives. And having that all available without having to drive across town is a big plus. One of the things I remember from 10 years ago when we began all of this was looking at our parents and looking at their lives and thinking they're a bit lonely. It's impossible to get around easily. So to go across town to visit friends doesn't happen anymore. And people get more and more withdrawn, more and more, hermits in their own homes. And again, I think that's tragic. I think that's what makes us age quicker, is just not having access to each other.
Is it a bit like being married to five people?
Yes.
We've alluded to the question of support. And so there's really a strong element of support. So, for example, a couple of years ago, Eve had her hips done. She had a double hip replacement. So Rick and I were here, as well as her husband, Daniel. So because there were four of us dealing with it, we were able to provide a lot more than just if she and Daniel had been trying to handle it on their own. And we will, somebody's going to lose a spouse at some point. And, we've seen from our own parents when that happens that it's a hugely lonely time. There's an irreparable loss for them in that. And, we'll be able to provide more support in times like that.
And even on the simplest day-to-day level, there's a very easy arrangement of people cook in turn. Somebody from the couple would turn out a meal in the evening, and pretty well we always have that if we're here. But there's nothing rigid or fixed about that. So it's an easy arrangement that gives us a lot of extra benefit.
There's also the other thing that happens between the six of us, which has always been so, even as friends just getting together socially, is that there's a lot of skill sharing. So we have a lot of experience and talents and different skills between us, and we get a lot done for each other and with each other and for ourselves that we wouldn't otherwise easily do.
We're standing in the open shared space of the house, and it's got a fairly high ceiling, and the kitchen has a really big island bench space and lots of cupboard space. And then we're looking at the lounge room, which has a potbelly stove, and the dining room. But it's all one big space. Can you tell me about it?
You can see over the kitchen that there are windows and louvers. So this is part of John's design. This is a place where in winter the sun comes through into this space. And also the louvers are there so that in summer there's a lot of easy movement of air through the space and providing cooling. It was very important to us not to have air conditioning or central heating from an energy efficiency and a cost point of view.
And you've got two huge fridges.
Fridges, yeah.
What was that about?
Well, for six people, you need freezing space and you also need enough cooling space. So while we make meals for one another, we have different dietary preferences and perhaps needs as well. And that may change also as time goes on, like develop further. Like, if somebody got diabetes or somebody gluten intolerant or whatever. So each of us has a space in this pantry or larder, walk-in larder to
It's huge. Let's walk in. It smells beautiful, all the garlic and everything that's in here.
Yeah, and you can see some common tastes.
You engaged a local architect, and he was somewhat challenged by the site from having read your blog, partly because the site was facing in the wrong direction in order to take full advantage of passive solar. What happened there?
John Basden is our designer's name, and he's a real focus on the solar, on solar efficiency, and a creative genius. So, yes, when he first looked at the site, he thought, oh, well, if you'd consulted with me before you bought this, I'd have said, you know, find something that's north-facing rather than south-facing.
Move the hill.
But it just meant that he had to design it with solar efficiency in mind and compensate in ways that he might not otherwise have had to do. So there are, you know, thickened glass on the view sides of the house. So we're having to look through the thickened glass, which is fine. We don't notice this, but John was having to pay attention to these things in the design.
And did he balk at the idea of designing for three couples to live both independently and together?
He tried.
I'm sure he quailed inside, but he was always very, very open and forthcoming and generous about it.
And there are certain aspects of the design, like the corridors have are quite wide and there are a couple of access ramps. Can you talk about why you've made those particular decisions?
We're getting older, and that there's six of us, the likelihood there's going to be walkers in our lives, that there could even be a wheelchair in our lives is, I think, something to face.
You can see we're at that time where there are things starting to change for us physically, for example. And so designing a life and designing a living setup which allows you to segue from city-based, very active, highly involved individual or family to something where you've actually got to start planning in more recreation, maybe therapeutic matters like physiotherapy. So it's just important to pick the time and know that it's coming at you, design something and make the change while it's still possible to do it.
So you're saying don't leave it too late.
Don't leave it too late, yeah.
Producer Claudia Taranto there with the Shedders, as they call themselves. That's two of the three couples who've designed a house to share their retirement years in near Taree in coastal New South Wales. And a question for you, what do you think about this? Would you share your retirement with your friends? Do you think it's a good idea? Or if not, why not? We would love to hear from you. Links are on our website where you can also find links to their blog and some images of the house. Coming up soon, although the design industry in China is quite new, there are unprecedented numbers of design graduates emerging. So what's the future for Chinese designers? And what obstacles and opportunities does this create for Australian designers today? That is our panel coming up soon.
Your say.
Yes, it is your say, and I'm very pleased to be joined by Jan Ryan, because we've been talking about shoes and lasts and things on how to protect antique silk, nostalgia. All these ideas have been coming in from listeners. Hello, Jan.
Hello, Fenella.
Forgot to say hello to you.
Hello, hello, hello. Yes, it's a very nostalgic day today. We've gone from Dior and skinny waist. Remember skinny waist?
No, actually.
I don't think anyone has a skinny waist anymore. One of the lovely letters that came in last week was about, in response to our story about shoes, making of shoes and shoe lasts, and Stuart Rothwell emails. My family emigrated to Australia in 1957 when I was just seven, when my Lancastrian father was appointed as head of the boot and shoe department at Collingwood Technical College in Melbourne, which taught all the trade skills for Melbourne's then large footwear industry. And he goes on to say, I loved the snippet of your interview with the last maker. There were always hardwood lasts lying around our house, and I always found them beautiful objects. Mm. My most enduring memory of my brief connection with the shoemaker's craft is of my father's razor-sharp clicking knife. Occasionally I would see him cutting leather around the pattern, and my memory of the precision with which he worked harks back to a time when everyone's dad had a manual skill worth watching.
There you go. Thank you very much for that letter. Also, Christine writes in as well and says, I was interested to hear your broadcast about shoe lasts. On a recent caravan trip in central New South Wales, I noticed a long abandoned shop with a fine array of very old and dusty lasts in its front windows. I wonder if the owner of the old shop realises their value. That's such a lovely image, though, I must say. Mm-hmm. And also, you might remember a listener that we read from a letter that we read from listener Paul Sinek, who wrote to us in December last year, just asking you if you had any advice about how to care for antique silk fabric. Jan, he said, I have a piece of silk fabric woven on a hand loom by my grandfather, who was the last of the silk weavers to operate a hand loom in London. I would like to do something with this swatch. I would like to preserve it, to give it some meaning. It's approximately 50 centimetres long by 15 centimetres wide. And we've had some really great ideas.
Yeah, we have. Many people have emailed with their thoughts and ideas. And here's a couple of ideas for you, Paul. Carol Lloyd says, any good framer, of which there are many, could frame the silk by stitching to a suitable material and then framing it. This does no harm to the material and preserves and supports its weave. Vic Langsam suggests going to the National Gallery in Victoria, which has the finest displayed collection of antique fabric, and also suggests the Australian National Gallery in Canberra, which apparently has superb pieces of hand-woven cloths. So there's some good hints there.
Yeah, good practical advice for caring for our things, the things that we already have. And also, just to wrap up, Jan, some great comments on Facebook to some of our posts, including the announcement in the Sydney Morning Herald in 1957 of the winning design for the Sydney Opera House and the introduction of our architect, Jørn Utzon. Aaron McKay wrote on Facebook, I wonder how many times over it has paid for itself. Tourism, advertising, attraction, socialising, eating, dining, concerts, festivals, businesses, more business, well-being, fun and enjoyment. Very good point. Mm. And thank you for all your letters. Do appreciate it. And thank you, Jan.
Thank you, Fenella.
See you next week. And that is Your Say for Today. Do join us on our Facebook page. We do post many, many great pictures of houses and fascinating buildings. And of course, you can also comment on our website at abc.net.au/radionational. Coming up next, our panel today is all about China and design in China. I'll be joined by the creative director of Beijing Design Week, the founder of the Design China website, and a design academic. But we were talking about Dior earlier and French design, I suppose. So here is a French duo, Isaac Delusion and Midnight Sun. By Design, that is the music of the French duo. They call themselves Isaac Delusion. It's very pretty, isn't it? That one is called Midnight Sun. Now, we all know the cliches that the Chinese only copy, that they're just following Western trends. And for Australian designers, China's economic boom is often seen as something of a gold rush. But looking more closely at China, the picture is more complex. In 2006, China's ex-premier, Hu Jintao, famously announced that he wanted to shift from made in China to designed in China. On the ground, a revival of craft traditions is quietly gaining pace in the midst of rapid modernisation. So are Australian designers too busy looking for opportunities to make money off China's boom that they're missing opportunities for genuine engagement? A big topic, and that's what we're discussing today. And my guests joining me are Arik Chen, who's the former creative director of the 2012 Beijing Design Week and a curator of design and architecture at M+ Museum in Kowloon. Zara Arshad, who is a designer and the founder of the website Design China, and also Ian MacArthur, who is a lecturer in design at the College of Fine Arts in Sydney and the founder of the Collaborate Project, fostering collaborations between Chinese and Australian design education programs. Arik, Zara and Ian, thank you for your time. Welcome to the program.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Arik,
good to have you on the show. Arik, if I could begin with you, you're an American-born Chinese, but you left a successful career as a design critic to work in Beijing. Tell me a bit about what it was like when you got there. What was the mood of the place?
Yeah, well, I arrived in Beijing soon after the Olympics in December of 2008, and I think following up on that event, I think there was an incredible amount of optimism in the air, so to speak. I think the Olympics had definitely put a big spotlight on China, in ways good and bad, of course. But I think overall, the Chinese did a very good job of sort of dazzling the world, and that happened to coincide with me being ready for a change, and that's how I wound up there.
Okay, and what could we learn then about design in China? What were some things that Westerners might be interested to hear about design?
Well, I think, somewhat facetiously, I think a lot of Westerners might be surprised to hear that it even exists in some ways. Last year, Beijing Design Week brought a show of Chinese design to the Salone del Mobile period in Milan, which is sort of the world's largest annual design gathering. And just to see the reactions on some of the visitors' faces and things that they said, it was clear that they were all very surprised to see that so much was going on in China.
Mm. There's also many design schools. There's an unprecedented number of graduates coming out of the design schools as well, isn't there? So it's really growing.
Yeah, no, it's definitely growing. I mean, I think there is that question of where are all these graduates going, which is a big question. But there is it definitely. Speaks of a hugely burgeoning interest in design in China.
Mm. The quote that I gave earlier from ex-Premier Hu Jintao, that the made in China to designed in China, why did that happen? Why is design so important to the Chinese state?
Yeah, well, I think it's become clear to them, as well as a lot of other people, that the China's current sort of low-cost export economy is not sustainable for much longer, and so as the government tries to shift the economy more towards innovation, creativity, and consumption, internal consumption, meaning Chinese need to find Chinese products desirable as well, they're putting greater emphasis on design.
Mm. What are the consumers then in China like? How have they changed then?
I think there is a huge curiosity about design. And a growing awareness of more in the context of, you know, quote unquote lifestyle. I think there's a lot of, as Chinese become wealthier, they are more interested in what the sort of Chinese lifestyle means to them, and that gets expressed through design. Right now, the interest is probably more in international brands, more because they have the sort of greater credibility in China. But I think there is a lot of desire to support Chinese designers who can get to a certain level.
Mm. So what are the obstacles then for Chinese designers if, as you say, there's a look towards overseas, if the design industry in China is quite new? How do they bypass these obstacles, create opportunities for themselves?
Yeah, well, I mean, like everywhere, there are a lot of obstacles. I mean, the ones that Chinese designers face that are similar to the designers elsewhere, you know, are largely, you know, economic. Having a market that's big enough and willing to pay for their work, as well as sort of distribution issues and so on and so forth. But I think more unique to Chinese designers is that structurally, the system in China is not really for all the sloganeering about made in China to design in China. The system is not yet ready support design and creativity the way they need to be supported.
How does it need to change? How does that structure need to alter for it to be supported?
Well, I would say that I think it needs to be a little there. This goes hand in hand with the sort of larger economic issues in China right now. I think things are a bit too top down. Too many resources are concentrated in the hands of too few entities, especially state owned enterprises, and so they tend to have a monopoly on what's possible. So while there are a lot of young designers and even entrepreneurs who are gunning to do something, the resources and access often aren't there.
Mm. Zara, maybe I could bring you in here on this very question. You're the designer and the founder of the website Design China. What sort of structural changes then do you think need to happen to enable and to support design in China?
I think I completely agree with Eric. What I find through my interviews with young emerging talent is that there's not enough support for them to to develop from the graduate status to a more established status. So I think there needs to be some sort of nurturing program, whether that means in terms of finances or expertise or resources, to allow them to just shift from a graduate to practicing.
And so what are some of the problems then that they're concerned with, the emerging designers? What are they encountering?
I think it's just the lack of external support. I think a lot of them find that upon graduating, they are very much on their own in terms of establishing their own studios, finding clients, or creating designs that are ready for the market.
Okay. Ian MacArthur joins me as well. He's from the College of Fine Art. He is an Australian design educator and has been leading groups of design students on collaborative exchanges to China for almost 10 years, which is a little bit about what we're talking about, Ian, I suppose. Tell us a bit about the projects that you run under the Collaborate banner. How did it start?
Well, it started in about 2003 when I returned from working in China for a period of about 3 years. And, of course, while I was there, I observed all this massive change. And my feeling was that it presented Australian designers with tremendous opportunities, but there was also this implication of a lot of challenges, global challenges, because of the complexities of the problems of such rapid advancement throws up. And so I've felt that when I returned to Australia, I began to work in the TAFE system as a head teacher, that there was an opportunity to link back to the situation where I was working in Shanghai and put students from Australia and China together and initially get them to collaborate online. Mm. And the project started at a very small scale, just like exchanging email and using very basic websites and addressing very simple problems, design problems that were about, you know, themes of everyday life, trying to maybe reveal similarities or cultural difference or create curiosity. And the projects have gradually evolved as I've become engaged in working at the university here in Sydney.
Listening to Arik and to Zara speak as well about some of the issues that occur for the graduates coming out of the design schools in China, Do you feel that there are similarities between the Australian stories and what they're talking about in China?
In terms of professional experience, I think there are some similarities, yeah, definitely. Obviously, it's a much larger market in China, and I think it's a much more difficult market to be successful in. Mm. And I agree with Arik that the appreciation for design and what it can do for business and industry and people, it's not quite there yet.
You also talk about the fact that for a lot of Australian designers, there are many guides, I suppose, that talk about how to successfully break into the Chinese market, which is a different focus. But you also think that we need to have a radical rethink of this. Why is that?
Okay, well, I feel that as a designer and a design educator, I've become less and less interested in design as a tool of, you know, commerce, and more interested in it as a means of implementing social change. And that's kind of informing a lot of the ideas I've got about shared vision, which are influenced by theorists like the Italian design theorist Ezio Manzini. And his argument is that many designers are involved in just upholding a status quo that's kind of leading us in not a very good direction. And so I think that there's an opportunity if we can create collaborative scenarios between Chinese and Australians, in our case, we can sort of start to envisage alternative futures that are perhaps more positive and sustainable.
Zara, can I get your perspective on this kind of cross-cultural collaboration that Ian is doing with Collaborate as well? How important do you think, then, is it for this kind of global outlook?
I feel that it is fairly important, especially in terms of bridging China with the rest of the world. So in terms of what Ian's doing, linking, in essence, Australian design students with Chinese design students, I very much feel that they can each learn off one another. And I feel if we facilitate a lot more interaction in this way, we not only foster understanding between two different cultures, but also I think the design industries in both countries in question given that opportunity to grow just that much further.
What exactly is being designed? What are we talking about here anyway, Zara and Arik, in China? Are we talking about clothes, furniture, cars? Where are the good things happening?
Well, the short answer is all of the above. I mean, there's a lot of activity going, and a lot of effort going into all those areas. At the moment, I would actually say architecture is probably a bit further ahead than a lot of the other design disciplines, and certainly graphic design as well. Fashion is sort of coming up there. Product and furniture is kind of lagging, is sort of the a bit further, I would say, but quickly catching up.
Zara, do you agree that the architecture is certainly on the rise, or has been for quite some time? What are some other areas that you can identify?
I do agree that architecture has been quite popular for quite some time now, especially with the so-called architects coming into China and using the country as almost like their playground. I think that's very much helped to foster this. I think that fashion is actually quite far developed as well. There are a lot of young emerging designers that have been exposed, for example, in publications like Vogue. A lot of Chinese designers are winning London awards, such as the Vauxhall Scout Award. So I do feel that fashion is quite far advanced as well. And I would certainly agree with Arik in the sense that the furniture design, although there are a large number of designers, both established and emerging, that are looking now into crafts and sort of the impact of heritage on this area, it probably is something that needs to be developed further in terms of market-ready products.
Arik, could you speak a little bit more then about this craft revival that is happening on the ground in China?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think this revival is coming from a few things. One, you know, with all the rapid sort of changes in China in recent decades, there is this impulse to sort of balance that with the rediscovery of more traditional craft techniques, at least, though reinterpreted probably in contemporary ways. At the same time, I think China is starting to, or a lot of Chinese are starting to question why China has become known for sort of cheap and cheaply made goods, when for most of history it was actually, you know, known for producing goods of the
high
quality.
Mm.
Yeah. So I think they're finding they're searching for those roots and trying to kind of bring those to the present, or those sensibilities to the present. And at the same time, I think they're wondering where they as Chinese sort of fit into the world. So there is a bit of a bit of an identity project going on with this craft interest.
What does this mean then, Ian? I can see you nodding here. What does this mean then for Australian designers? What are Australian designers learning from this connection?
Well, I'm not sure how much they're learning, because I'm not sure how much they're actually engaging with it, which is
the big
part
problem.
It's the big problem, yeah. And I think that there's a lot of assumptions about China. Not just in Australia, but elsewhere, you know, about what it is, what it means, what the implications for the future are. And I think that designers in Australia and elsewhere have to really put the time in and the effort into trying to understand what the implications are and what the culture is and where it's headed.
Mm. Arik, do you agree? I suppose the question is, what is then a healthy design relationship between countries?
Yeah, I think probably education is one of the best ways to collaborate, because I think it's good to sort of get designers when they're young and perhaps I wouldn't say more open, because the designers tend to stay tend to be open-minded people in general, but at least in their training early on to start seeing and being exposed to different ways of thinking and different ways of seeing the world.
Zara, your thoughts, a healthy design relationship then between countries?
I think I'd like to expand on Arik's point. I also think that healthy design relationship also entails a willingness to perhaps cross disciplines and collaborate with others. And I think an open mind is needed in order to do that. I very much think that designers should start sharing with one another, whether that means internally in their own countries or externally internationally, and bring different skills and knowledge sets to various collaborative projects. And I think this in turn, this very people-focused knowledge transfer process is what a healthy design relationship should be, rather than focusing on quick money.
It is a long topic, I think. It's something I think we must return to here on By Design. Just to wrap up our conversation about design and China, I just wanted to ask very quickly if you have a tip, Zara, on a favourite Chinese designer.
Typically, I don't think I can pick just one.
Very quickly, just one.
although not practicing exclusively as a designer, I'm a huge fan of Oning, who has pioneered several architectural and design projects that explore the unexplored, as it were. And secondly, very quickly, I'd like to mention Freeman Lau. Although he's not from mainland China, he's from Hong Kong and practices in product, industrial and graphic design. And I think he exemplifies very beautifully and very poetically how much of an impact culture and heritage can actually have on design. So I think there's a lot that can be learned from his work.
Thank you very much, Zara. Unfortunately, we've run out of time, but we're going to put up those pics on our Facebook page as well for our favourite Chinese designers. And many thank you to our guests, Arik Chen, Zara Arshad and Ian MacArthur. Thank you for joining me on By Design. Appreciate
it. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
And that is By Design for today. It's been great to be with you. It's produced by Jan Ryan and Diane Dean. Our sound engineer is Anne-Marie de Bettencourt, and I'm Fenella Kernebone.
I'm Cassie McCullough.
And I'm Jason DiRosso. And this week on the first edition of our new program, The List...
Trashy reality TV and the cult of the makeover. Is it really self-improvement or just ritual humiliation?
And have we entered a collective neurosis about sex and gender? Signs of a fresh debate are everywhere, from the breastfeeding backlash to a car commercial. What's behind it all?
That's just a few of the things on The List. You can download it from the RN website.